Thank you. Well, I'm going to go somewhat in circles. Well, first of all, I guess I should say that this lecture is not Once Upon a Time in the West. And I wrote a long thing on the plane explaining why it's not, but actually I think I'll spare us that to say it's not. I guess it was partly because I was chickening out on speaking about Paul Celan and speaking about translation, because I think that the importance of the project for me of trying to read Celan's work has been to read it as someone incapable of reading it, and yet positioned in relation to it in a way that made me, in a megalomaniacal sense that I would not want to admit, have some sympathetic understanding of it. And so the attempt to articulate what that would be is really what my translations and any writing I've done about Celan have been. So I don't have a paper to read, but I have a lot of little papers. And what I'm going to try and do is give a context for Celan's poetry and for why I'm interested in it, how I came to it, what I'm doing with it. And at the center of it will be, I'm going to read a translation of what is really his longest poem and maybe his only long poem, called Ing Furon. And I have a short translator's note on that poem, too. So that was the center. Now I'm going to go back and I'm going to do a circumference. I thought to begin by reading this very brief two-page note that I wrote to remind myself when I was coming here what my workshop was about, and then I read that again yesterday in the workshop as a way of summarizing the first day. And really, what I had to say about Emily Dickinson is equally applicable to Paul Celan, and it's not coincidental. They're very related poets, and in fact, Celan was Dickinson's translator into German and one of the very first to translate her work into German. And so this will be like in the way of theory. So when I say Emily Dickinson, and this is part of the process of translation, because I think that when you say any writer's name, you're not saying just one writer, you're saying that writer and everything that contributes to what that writer is about, whether it's in the realm of literature and what that writer has read, or in the way of history. And so when I say Emily Dickinson, it's not just simply a book that one holds in one's hands. What we are addressing in this class, before and after the question of Emily Dickinson's poetry and the war, is the question how to read. We are going to be reading for information and listening to the poem and looking hard at it, because a poem is a document that marshals every resource at its command in the articulation of meaning. And Dickinson, in particular, is a frugal author. She lets not a morsel of ink be wasted in the meal she prepares for us, her troops. In the background, as theory, or as a picture of poetry, to help us think about these issues, I want you to conceive of the meaning of a poem as having three faces: the act, the occasion, and the object. When reading, we're swaying on the point of the pyramid, and three sides slant down from the point. And if we lose balance, we tumble down one of them and no longer are able to look down from the tip of all three. And this idea of there being of these three faces, the act and the occasion and the object, developed for me out of some ideas I had, which was in an essay that I wrote that was published in Lynn Hajinian's magazine, Poetics Journal, under the title Lyrical Interference, where I wanted to say that for me what lyric means, what makes a poem lyric as opposed to another kind of poem, which in this day is really not a form, not something that's in the form of the words, but really in the way we read. If we read a poem as a lyric poem, as opposed to as an epic poem or a dramatic poem, the question of the sources of that work is the absolutely central question, and that if we read without regard to what the sources of the poem are, then we're reading it superficially for sake of beauty or knowledge or culture. And what attracts me to the work of Dickinson, but especially to Paul Celan, is that these sources are absolutely catastrophic events that in studying the relation of these poets to these events, there's so much to learn about our responsibility to history as the people who inherit, as the ones who inherit it. So if that's not too theoretical, now I will speak in a very practical manner about why I'm reading Paul Celan and why I'm reading him the way I am. Because I think that without citing this very personal anecdotal information, really I think there's not much use in what I'm doing, because I'm adding another mistranslation to the library of mistranslations. I first read Paul Celan's work because the old Penguin edition that had Michael Hamburger's translations was in my father's library. My father, who is a survivor, for some reason was teaching a class on literature of the Holocaust, something which he is absolutely unequipped to teach, having absolutely no appreciation of literature, and finding actually literature is not very useful for teaching history, and so that was the only time he taught it. But he had this book, and I read it, I read two or three poems in it, and what I saw was that this poet, who is considered, in all accounts, I think George Steiner says, the one pure poet to come out of the Holocaust, by and large doesn't write about the Holocaust. And so to imagine what that relation is, to imagine that one writes about something by not writing about it, that had a profound impact on me. But the work itself was too difficult to read, and so I put it aside and I didn't read it again. But I always considered Paul Celan one of my most important poets. And then maybe 4 or 5 years ago, Benjamin Hollander edited an issue of the magazine Acts, and the other editor, David Levi Strauss, will be here next week, dedicated to the work of Celan. And I read the introduction, and I vehemently disagreed with his point of view on the basis of absolutely no information. And in particular, two points, one which are generally taken points about Celan's work, which my intuition told me were absolutely not true for my reading of the work. One is that he was engaged in the process of, in some way, redeeming the German language or reclaiming it from the Nazis after the war. And to just say a little bit about Celan, he's a Romanian-born Jew who grew up studying in school in German, in a German language school, and his parents were murdered during the war, and he was interned in a labor camp during the war, pulling stones from a river or some such hard labor. And then after the war, found his way ultimately, I think by around 49, in Paris, and lived in Paris the rest of his life and wrote in German. And much speculation has gone to why he chose to write in German and what that means. And in fact, it's a pretty fascinating question. And so it's generally taken that the project of writing in German was to redeem this language and take it back. And then the other thought of his work that is taken as generally true is that he's engaged in the process of responding, upbraiding, in some way refuting the works and the ideas and the ideologies of the German tradition, the German Romantic tradition, and of Christianity. And I think the word that's generally used for that is a Widerruf, that he writes poems that are in homage to a certain figure, and these are a Widerruf, a refutation. Anselm probably can give a more exact definition of this word. And my sense... Call back. So, refute. Well, and so to be short about it, my sense has always been that that he's interested in language as power, and in the German language in its particular power, in a way that does not at all transcend the meaning of power within the context of Nazi Germany. And so to redeem the language would be in some way to dissolve whatever power it has from that time. And I don't think he gets out of that, the maelstrom of that, his entire life. And we can look at poems, and we can think of examples of how language was power at that time, and not just for the Nazis, but for those who spoke the German language within the empire of Nazi Germany, both in the camps and outside of them. And then the other thing is that I believe his relationship to Christianity and to the German Romantic tradition is very complicated and is not at all in the manner of a refutation. And I think one sign of this is the name he took for himself. He was born Paul Antschel, and the Romanian spelling of that is A-N-C-E-L, with the C being not a C, but because it has a little thingamajig on the bottom of it. And the name he took was a anagram of that, Ceylon, and in part a citation of Tomas of Celano, a monk of, I guess it must be the 12th century, who was in the order of St. Francis and who wrote the great, very beautiful biography of Francis that most of our legends are traced from. And the idea of taking the name of a Christian witness to one of the great saints is very profound, and it's not in any manner a refutation of Celano's work, though it's not at the same time. Well, there's a late poem called Ashen Glory, which ends with the line, "Nobody witnesses for the witness," and Ceylon is the witness par excellence of our time. And as Ceylano is the witness to Francis, so Ceylon is also, to some extent, the witness to Ceylano and the witness to this tradition that he absolutely places himself within. And then again, there's so much more that, you know, we can talk about later about this, what it means for him to take this name and what his relation to Francis is. His first child, who died after a few months, was named Francois. It's also, which is the French name for St. Francis. It's also in some way a name for his mother, Friederike. So to begin with this, I wrote to Benjamin and I said, in a long letter, 5 pages, absolute disagreement. And on the basis of all my experience of writing to poets and disagreeing with them, I expected, you know, one of a few responses. Very angry defense, no answer, or a very polite, thank you for sharing your comments with me. That was very kind of you. What I got back, and I think I wrote to absolutely the right person at absolutely the right time, but I got back something like a 15-page letter that was not explaining himself, but that was trying to understand what I had incoherently written to him and asking me to clarify. And since I had used up absolutely all of my knowledge in writing the first letter to him, in order to clarify what I had to say, I had to actually go and start reading the work again. And out of this began a dialogue that's really continued to the present, in which both of us have rethought really all our assumptions about the work and read it together. And I have something that I'll read later if seems relevant to do so, or if there's time or whatever, which is more a letter I wrote to Benjamin last year, shortly after Edmond Jabez died, and at the beginning of the, just before the Gulf War started. And in our reading of Ceylon together, really everything about ourselves has been implicated. And for instance, about 6 months ago, Benjamin's father, who left Berlin in the 30s for Palestine, committed suicide in his 80s. And his father had come to this country during the Gulf War to get out of Israel. And during that time, this was before the recent biography of Ceylon had been brought out into English, Benjamin gave his father a copy of the biography and asked him if he'd be interested in translating it, because his father's retired and needed something to do. And I guess, as I haven't said, Paul Ceylon committed suicide in 1970, threw himself into the Seine. And, you know, Benjamin and I have asked each other, well, what are we stirring up in looking at this work and dragging our families into this? So it's, and I cite that only to say that this is a project that is not, it's not a literary project, really. It's not really what it's about. So actually, I was going to say more about who Paul Ceylon is, but it doesn't seem necessary in some way. So maybe I'll read this poem, and then I'll read this short note afterwards. And the poem is titled in German, Engführung, which is a musical term. And in English, we use an Italian word, so it's hardly worth translating. But the Italian word is stretto. And I explain it in more detail in this note, but just briefly, it's a musical term that has to do with, in the fugue, when different passages are played so close together as to be played at the same time. And there are repeated phrases in here which are a gesture towards repeating that form. Suddenly my mouth is very dry. Passed through grounds with incontestable track, grass written asunder, stones white, stalk shadowed. Read no more, behold. Hold no more, begone. Go, thy hour hath no sisters. Thou art homeward. A slow wheel rolls out of itself. The spokes climb, o'er blackish field they climb. The night needeth no stars. Nowhere is there asking after thee. Nowhere is there asking after thee. The place where they rest, it has a name, has none. They didn't rest there. Something rested between them, they saw not through to. Saw not, no, spoken by word. None woke, the sleep came over them. Came. Nowhere is there asking. 'Tis I rested tween you. I was open, audible. I ticked to you, your breath obeyed. 'Tis I, still and ever. You sleeping, yes. Tis still and ever. Years. A finger gropes down and over, gropes round. Seams palpable here gaped wide asunder. Here grew again together. Who covered it up? Covered it up. Who? Came. Cameth a word came. Came through night. Would glow. Ashes. Night and night. To the eye gone, to its dampening. To the eye gone, to its dampening. Hurricanes ere hence particle storming, the other thou knoweth, yes, we read from books, was notion. was notion. How else grabbed on, we on, with these hands? It stood also written that, where, thereon we made a silence, poison allayed, large, a green silence, a sepal, it hung on a thought was vegetable. Green, yes, hung, yes, neath malignant sky. Of, yes, vegetable, yes, hurricanes, particle storming, remanded time, remained by stone to seek, he, hospitable, ne'er meddled a word, how good we had it. Kinked and fibrous, stipular, dense, racemose and radial, pitted, plated, clotted, a slack, a rootage, he, it, ne'er meddled a word, but spoke willingly to parched eyes ere it closed them. Spoke, was. We allowed no slack, stood midst a poured framework, and it came down on us, came through to, mended invisibly, amended last membrane, and a thousand crystal world shot out. Shot out, then. Nights, mixed out, circles, green or blue, red squares. The world puts her inmost in play with new hours. Circles, red or black, shining squares, nary a flight shadow, nary a plane table, nary a smoke soul climbs and plays along. Climbs and plays along. In the owl flight, by petrified leprosy, by our shunned hands, nearest rejection, beyond the bullet catch, the crumbling wall, visible anew, the furrows, the choirs, as then, the psalms, ho, Hosanna. Thus stands the temple, still, a star presumably hath light, still, nothing is lost. Hosanna. In the owl flight, hear the conversation, day grayed of a creek's tracing. Day grade of a creek's tracing. Passed through grounds with incontestable track. Grass, written asunder. So that's the poem. The title in German is Engführung. For all native speakers, please forgive my barbaric pronunciation. Although, in reading a review of Shoah, one of the reviewers said that Lanzmann speaks German fluently and without any regard for the finer as well as the coarser points of grammar and pronunciation, as if the language merited nothing but contempt. So I took a little bit of comfort from that. And then, I'll read maybe this brief bit of prose about the poem, which might give a way to talk about it, and then we could try and have questions and conversation, and if that doesn't seem to be happening, then maybe I'll read this other thing or just blather on some more. And I begin with a quotation from the German Jewish philosopher Franz Rosenzweig. The power of world history breaks against this quiet life which looks neither right nor left. Ingfjörung, the long poem concluding Paul Celan's 1959 collection Sprachgitter, which translates as speech grill, takes as its title the technical term in German music for what in English, following Italian usage, we call stretto, the counterpoint maintained by playing two musical passages at once. Stretto is Italian for narrow and derives from the Latin strictus, drawn tight. The German Engführung is a literal translation. Eng means narrow. Die Führung, related to das Führer, leader, refers to the conducting. In the fugue, as one definition puts it, the stretto is an artifice by which the subject and answer are, as it were, bound close together by being made to overlap. Celan's adaptation of this intricate form shows in his repetition of key phrases, an overlapping which binds sections of Engfjörung each to next and beginning with end. Such musical structure, especially as referred to the fugue, recalls Celan's most famous poem, Todesfuga, Death Fugue, written in Romania in the summer of 1944, a work which, like Engfjörung, takes, quote, the passion of Israel under Nazism, lamentation of lamentations, which is statement of Emmanuel Levinas, as its theme. In musical notation, stretto further denotes the instruction to play a passage in quicker tempo, the opposite of largo, title of another later work of Celan's, a poem said to address Martin Heidegger. If music is time's articulation, then those poetries aspiring to music are above all a disclosure of what time elsewise must devour. Time which for Shakespeare delves the parallels in beauty's brow, which is a poem that Celan translated during the war. The time appointed by God and portioned out by Solomon in Ecclesiastes. I would only believe in a God that knew how to dance, writes Friedrich Nietzsche. This same German philosopher, in a book long discredited after the war, The Will to Power, provides a source for one of Paul Celan's most often quoted statements. Speak, but don't split the no from the yes. The poem containing these lines, Speak You Also, contains as well the following command. Give your text sense also. Give it shadow. Give it enough shadow. Give it as much as you know to be divvied out for you between midnight and midday and midnight. The spur of Engfjörung, its hastening, its quote, straightening, unquote, as Michael Hamburger translates the title, is time. Time experienced historically, apocalyptically, and as mortality. The fugue is this time's access, its rehabilitation. Thus, Maurice Blanchot, citing the Hosiana with which Engfjörung comes to prayerful end, notes acutely how, quote, the Hebraic cry of jubilation begins, divided with a moan, unquote. And this is because there's a line break in the Hosiana. The Ho is on one line and the Ziana. This division, splitting as it were the yes from the no, occurs in time itself, palpable where grass is written asunder, where the living, interposed between sun and earth, regard the silhouettes of plants on white stone. In Engfjörung, the psalmist's light, broken, bears thought to the content of the gesture with which our lives vanish. It is, in Celan's formulation, a speaking with shadow. One of the final tribulations of this poem is the loneliness of the poet's separation from what he would commemorate, his disengagement from the unnamed sources of his poem. Early on in Engfjörung, these sources, traced like the underground meanderings of a stream, lead the poet, a former inmate of the concentration camps, to a blackish field of starless graves, an hourless expanse of night where Ezekiel's wheel rolls back toward the terrible ice of another world. Nowhere, writes Celan, speaking to his thou, one of two, the poem lets us know, suggesting a recitation for parents murdered by the Nazis. Nowhere is there asking after thee. Engführung marks a critical juncture in this poet's development, coming at the end of Sprachgitter, a book that turns from Rilkean beauty and surrealist pathos, from a poetry Ceylon himself calls with rare sarcasm the, quote, unending pronouncement of utter mortality and vanity, unquote, toward what Peter Zondi terms the poem as speech tissue, stretched taut in the expanse between signified and signifier, sense and sound. Engführung is both a summation and heralding, typical of neither late nor earlier work. In fact, he never wrote another poem that's of this length or that really has the same tone. Ceylon's next collection will be Die Niemandsrose, The No One's Rose, 1963, a volume taking up thematically where Sprachgitter leaves off, with an untitled poem beginning, "There was dirt in them and they dug," a poem which once moved Bruno Bettelheim in an essay on the camps to speak of the survivor as like, quote, a child destroyed by his earliest experiences. Between Sprachgitter and Die Niemandsrose, Ceylon will issue his prose piece Conversation in the Mountains, will deliver his brilliant acceptance speech for the Georg Büchner Prize in Darmstadt, and will publish his groundbreaking translations of Ossip Mandelstam. In all three of these works, to borrow a locution from the second, Ceylon takes to paths on which language becomes stimmhaft, vocal. On paths as these, the poet stares down his Medusa, recording the fallen beauty of individual authority, the defeat of that part of thee which the poem alone shields, using petrified words gathered by shunned hands. Like few poets of his time, writes Ceylon, in a translator's note that applies equally well to his own work, Ossip Mandelstam upheld the poem as that place where what we perceive and attain across language is gathered around a center, the site where form and truth, Gestalt and Wahrheit, are one, around the individual, his existence, Dasein, interrogating the hour, his own and that of the eon. In Engführung, the one pure poem to come out of the fact of the death camps, George Steiner, Ceylon conducts us through the narrows of language, bringing us finally to a place where the temple still stands and nothing, nothing is lost. There, in a place without name, he interrogates his hour. And just to cite that, I think that what makes this poem, I mean, just to end this, what makes this poem so unusual, I think, is this idea that nothing is lost, which is this idea of redeeming. And I think that this is really the only place that he attempts to say that. So I don't know, maybe we can try and talk through it by way of dialogue, if anyone has any questions or comments or arguments. For me, it always has been.
This is more of a comment, but one thing that came to my mind about Ceylon and also Dickinson is that I guess it's kind of a Hebrew thing, a Hebrew belief in like they wouldn't say the name of Yahweh. There's more power in something when it's unnamed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. And Dickinson is a very much an Old Testament Christian. And I think that's the aspect of her that Ceylon was interested when he translated her. Those are the poems I think he went to.
I got here a little late into it, so I missed the Dickinson part, but... I was just wondering to what extent it could be said that Ceylon had any choice in the matter of language, because he was obviously raised in German, and in the German cultural sphere, and actually maybe even less the German than the old Austro-Hungarian Empire. Wasn't his homeland part of that at some point?
Yeah, actually.
So that in a way, that was his one and only language. I mean, he had the command of
He had the other. Well, he wrote some poems in Romanian, which is hard to imagine ever having been his choice. And in fact, the poem in which he announces himself as Paul Ceylan is a poem written in Romanian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those have been translated recently, haven't they?
Yeah, and that this Fruwerk, yeah.
Yeah.
Certainly, he could have gone and written in French in Paris. He seems to have had that facility. He could have gone to Israel, written in Hebrew, as many did.
Yeah, but so there is a very specific insistence on the quote-unquote good in German culture that made him, you know, prevail. And Widerruf, by the way, probably is more like calling against. Widerstand is resistance.
Shout down.
Yeah, shut down.
I don't know. So, I mean, I asked my dad about, because my father's from Berlin, what his sense was of a person from the town of Czernowitz in the Bukovina in the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. part of Romania, then under the Soviets, what their language would be. And he cynically said, well, if you're going to be a famous poet, you're going to write in one of the major European languages.
Very good point.
But he said that when he was a kid and someone would say that they were from Vienna, they would make fun of them by saying, a Wiener? Ah, a Buchowiener. Mm-hmm. Meaning, you're from the outskirts, you're from way out.
Way out, right.
So to be a poet of the German language is both, and to come to Paris, I mean, you know, it's like out of a Flaubert novel, right, to come to the city.
Well, it had a famous precedent in Heine. Heinrich Heine, another great German Jewish poet, went into exile in Paris. I mean, he no more than Ceylan any longer had a home in any German-speaking country. I mean, he had to literally leave, and Paris provided this place.
So. I've been fascinated by the question of the exiled Jew in Paris, and especially in this century. And I wonder who are the French Jews, because French culture is inconceivable to me without. First you have Levinas coming from Lithuania and studying in Germany and settling in Paris, writing. I mean, there's a person who could have written in any of several languages, writes in French, brings Heidegger's ideas to Sartre. There's Jabez coming from Egypt writing in French. There's Elie Wiesel coming from Transylvania and then this country, but he chooses to write in French. And though we don't think of him as being French culture, I imagine that the contemporary French novel would be inconceivable without his work.
There's Emil Cioran, who's Romanian, and I don't know if he's Jewish, but he's Romanian and writes in French, and actually was a friend, knew Ceylan somewhat.
And then Lev Shestov coming from Russia and living in Paris and writing in Russian.
I think Cioran says somewhere that Ceylan was one of the saddest people he'd ever met, which coming from him, you know, is quite remarkable. Yeah, okay, I think that's all right. Well, maybe you'd like to talk a little bit. I'm not too well up on that famous meeting between Heidegger, who obviously was accused of, if not collaborating with the Nazis, then at least keeping his mouth shut during them, and Ceylan, and they met at least once, didn't they?
Yeah, I guess they met twice. Well, it's interesting. I think that around the time that this poem that I read was written was probably when Ceylan was most actively reading Heidegger's work. The speech that he gave at this time, The Meridian, is very much within the analog of Heidegger's language and formulations. And in this poem, this recurring phrase, nowhere is there asking, in the German, which is much more succinct and powerful, nirgends fragt es nach dir. This fragt es, this it asks, is very much also the it of es gibt, it gives, which is in Heidegger there is. That's one of the ways in which he speaks of existence. And I think that he's using Heidegger's formulation for speaking of existence, not as a gift, but as an asking in which there is no, he's speaking about people who are dead, and there's not only is the person dead, but anyone who would have ever known this person is dead, which in the case of Ceylon's parents is not entirely true. But nevertheless, the idea that not only is there no traces of the person, but there's no traces of the people who would ask for those traces, a very profound response, I think, to Heidegger. Around 1967, a reading was arranged for Ceylon in Germany, one of his rare trips back, and he was going to be reading in Marburg, where Heidegger was living outside in his cabin in the village of Totenauberg in the Black Forest. And through mutual friends, it was communicated that Heidegger had a great, profound interest in Ceylon's work, purchased all the books as they came out, would like to meet him, and was going to come to the reading. So the reading was given. Heidegger came to town. I guess they had dinner beforehand. It was very friendly. Afterwards, they're standing at the hotel, and a photographer was going to take the picture of the two of them. And Ceylon suddenly freaked and says, "I don't want my picture taken with this gentleman." Everyone was embarrassed, and Heidegger, who was probably in his 70s at that time, said, "No, he doesn't want it, then we won't do it." The next day, Ceylon had been invited already for the next day to come out and spend the day with Heidegger at his cabin and take a walk in the forest. He went there. He signed in the visitor's log, and according to one of Heidegger's disciples who's written about this poem, apparently this visitor's log was the same book that had been the guest log back into the 20s, and so it had the names of prominent Nazis, including Ernst Jünger, in the book. Ceylon signed the book saying, giving the date and saying, with hope in the heart for a word that's coming. According to the lore, he was expecting that this great occasion had been arranged so that Heidegger could say something to Ceylon about the Holocaust or about his own relation to the Nazi Party. In some way, acknowledging some kind of complicity. And this is said not to have happened. But they took there's no record of the conversation they had, and I think that But because there is no record of it, we're free to speculate till the end of time. And I think the speculation is in some ways more valuable than some kind of shallow, note of forgiveness or some shallow apology. So when Ceylon got back to Paris, he wrote a poem for the occasion, which now I wish I had with me to read. It's a very curious thing. I wish I could remember the damn thing by heart, but I can't. But in the poem, he repeats this word. He repeats the what he had signed in the book, with a hope for a word coming in the heart. And he has this very strange formulation, which he says, "In the book, in this book." And the poem was published in one of Ceylon's books posthumously, but when he got back to Paris, it was published by itself as a book, the single poem in an edition of 200, and he sent the copy to Heidegger. And again, this is the subject of endless speculation. Is it a poem that attacks Heidegger, or is it a poem in honor of him? And Heidegger took it completely as an honor, as I imagine almost anyone would. But so when he says, "In the book, in this book," he makes the poem into the book. I mean, he makes the poem into this visitor's log, and by reinscribing this line in the poem, he's somehow transported this visitor's book into this poem. It's a very, very peculiar poem, and none of the analyses that I've ever read get to this mysterious aspect of it, which is, why is he recreating this book? And And I don't have an answer for it, but that's one of the things that I keep reading this poem looking for. Why would he do this? And it seems very related to his other activities as a poet. In some way, to recreate something in order to accomplish something, but what he is trying to accomplish is not stated and is really, in many cases, unfathomable. There are cases where one can see what he's doing. I guess those are the so-called translatable poems.
And you probably have more German now than I do, but is it clear in that poem whether it says in the poem, in this book, as opposed to in the poem, in this book?
He doesn't say the poem. He doesn't say the poem. He says book and book. He says in the book. He's in das, and it's one of those German phrases where between the das and the Buch there are many other words, but in das Buch, and then repeating it, in dieses Buch.
Oh, I see.
So it's the words poem side. This.
I'd like to ask you a question about the other side of this work. It seems like when you were reading your translation, there was this incredible, mostly sadness that I felt when I was listening, and it was very different from the work that you read a couple nights ago in PAC. And so what I'm wondering is, in terms of your own process, like you're reading Ceylon both as a scholar, you know in incredible detail a lot about what he did and what he was up to, but then what happens to you when you're working with the words? Do you feel like what images or what emotions are you bringing to that transcription? I mean, are they his?
Well, I've done most of this really late at night with the dictionary open, looking every word up, and so that one is... It is kind of a trance state, not in the sense of transmission from spirits, but I get very melancholy when I do the work, and the work certainly facilitates one's feeling melancholy. I would say that the translation is 95% my attempting to read the work, and only 5%, attempting to make something, so that most of the translations I've done, I would never even dream of reading, let alone showing to someone. And insofar as I'm trying to read the work, I'm trying to understand the context for it. I mean, this is where I always wanted to be a theorist, so this is where my theoretical structure of these three things, the act, the occasion, and the object, comes in. Trying to imagine what the occasion is and the act, how the poem was written and in what context it was written. I've been very much attracted to poems written for members of his family, or poems in which names are cited, poems that are dedicated, poems in which there are quotations that have been found by scholars so that one knows that he was reading Kafka or he was reading Meister Eckhart. And those give a clue as to what his attitude might be.
It seems in your work on him, you're invoking a poetic lineage that leans very heavily on what we call translation, but is also a sort of spiritual interaction with other writers. Do you feel that Ceylon was working in this way with Emily Dickinson, and you said Mandelstam, you talked about Emily Dickinson and Ceylon, both of them writing out of a historical catastrophe. Mandelstam obviously in camps also, till he died. What about Shakespeare? What was the connection there? And I'm asking also, was Ceylon translating these as part of his writing interest? These weren't just commissioned translations, I assume, where he was doing it just as a job.
Well, he did do professional translation. During the period before he came to France, when he was still in Romania under the Soviet occupation, he translated Chekhov from Russian into Romanian. He translated Kafka into Romanian. And also he translated two Simenon novels into German from French and some other stuff. I mean, I think his relationship with Dickinson is intuitive. I don't think that he knew, by accounts, his English wasn't all that good. And in other words, much better than my German. And I think he had an intuition about her work. He sensed the power of it. That's of a different kind of relationship than his relationship with Mandelstam, which was very intense and ongoing. And I mean, for instance, he translated 8 Dickinson poems, whereas he did something like 60 of Mandelstam's poems. And he had, this was at a time, I think this must have been before Mandelstam's widow had written her memoir or published it, or it had been translated into German. Lynn, you might know the dates of this stuff better than I do. But in her memoir, she gives an account of all the various stories of how Mandelstam might have died. And he apparently didn't have access to this, because in his translator's note, he said he speculates that having been transported having been in a transport camp under the Stalin, he was in the part of Russia that was ceded to the Nazis at the end of the war. And so, in fact, he was murdered not by the Russians, but by the Germans. In other words, imagining, in effect, that Mandelstam had the same fate that his parents had. And so I think that's a sign of a very acute sense of identification. And in fact, only 2 of his books are dedicated. The book Von Schwelle zu Schwelle, From Threshold to Threshold, is dedicated to his wife then. And the book Die Niemandsrose, the No One's Rose, is dedicated to the memory of Osip Mandelstam.
I forget the verb you used. Was it reclaiming the German language that Benjamin Hollander
redeeming, cleansing?
Yeah, I seem to hear or think of purifying with regard to that.
Yeah.
And I think, how can language really be purified? I mean, it's sort of like the corruption that seems to be where language lives.
Mm-hmm.
But and I don't know what, but there's also the sense of Celan being a pure poet, and whatever that is. And yeah. I don't know his work that well, but from what little bit I know of it, I can really see this impulse toward like a pure poetry in some way. And I was thinking of that, and this is more of a comment than a question.
Comments are better.
But then also there's this thing, now I totally forget what I wanted to say was the best thing too. oh well. Never mind. Can you comment on that? Did he want to redeem the German language?
Well, my feeling is that he didn't, and that this word pure is kind of an awful, I mean, you know, you can't help hearing in it this phrase, Judenrein, Jew-free. I think that he's called a pure poet in the sense in which he uses every aspect of the poem, meaning the whole history of a word. He's said to have worked from the dictionary and used ancient meanings as well as modern ones, but also the sound and the syllables, and I could give many examples, but the most common is just simply poems in which names are cited. And in German, this is very easy, since many of our common German names are words in German. You know, his prose piece, Conversation in the Mountains, is about 2 Jews walking in the mountains talking, Jew Klein and Jew Gross. Well, Klein and Gross are Jewish names, but they mean Jew Big and Jew Little. So in this sense, he's pure. He doesn't waste anything. And if there's something in there that doesn't make sense, I would say 99% sure it has meaning, and we just haven't figured it out.
Yeah, I was just wondering, you mentioned Rilke. I think most contemporary Germans tend to regard him as in the wake of Rilke. And in a sense, perhaps the only one, because post-World War II, German poetry really turned away from all that. Well, I'm thinking back to my own first times among German-speaking writers back in the late 50s. Metaphysical piffle, you know, is what they felt about Rilke. They didn't have Celan then, yet, at that time. So that German poetry took this other direction with, say, Brecht, very sort of down-to-earth, dialectical materialism and all that, and very funny. And or into different degrees of abstraction or concern with pure language, language games, essentially. Helmut Heisenbüttel, Gerhard Rühm, there's a long list of these people, many of whom are still active, and I wish our let us no longer call them language-oriented poets, but a certain generation of these poets would pay a little more attention to them than to the French, because there's some interesting stuff going on there, too. And this is more, again, in the nature of a comment. Oh, I did have a question. I just remembered it. I noticed you're using the, in order to translate do and dine and so forth, you use thou, thee, thine, and so forth. And hence, you also have to use those verb forms like thou art, you know. And I can see how with Celan, I suppose the intensity of the expression is so far away from the colloquial, in which those simply would be equivalents to our you, that you decided to make this choice to use the biblical, the older King James English to deal with that. Did you find any other aspects where it was necessary to return or to let's say jack up your English to that level?
Yeah, I really like using the thou because it's like getting a tattoo on your face. You know, it just marks you out of society. And I mean, do is especially as Celan uses the word, is completely untranslatable. It's the, and I don't even, what do they call it? They call it the familiar, the intimate, the, it's the way, yeah. And it's how one addresses a friend, a lover, but also God. And it's not you, and it's even more so not thou anymore. And it's a very specific relationship, and also technically it's very important because it's singular, and he often uses it in relation to the plural, as he does in this poem. And I took my permission to use the thou because Celan is a translated poet. There are two lengthy books that have come out, one actually that's out of print, done by Joachim Neugroschel, and then more recently reprinted one by Michael Hamburger. And then there are many other translations that either have not come out or have come out in ephemeral publications. And so, and I'm always struck by the fact that there are certain choices that need to be made and there aren't very good ones, and everyone makes the best choice, and therefore everyone makes the same choice. So I thought, okay, well, I'll make a different choice, and that way, this one aspect of the work, which in my case is the more biblical, the more jacked up aspect of the poetry, comes through. And it's absolutely wrong. And but it's, you know, it's just another facet. And for instance, this poem, there are, that I know of, three other translations that have been published, Neugroschel and Hamburger, and then also Sid Corman did a translation that came out in the 60s in Origin. And John Felstener, who's written a great deal about Celan's work, is working on another one. So I wasn't worried, well, people will get the wrong idea, because for one thing, people are, for the most part, aren't going to see my version. But if they did, it would certainly be after, in most cases, after these others.
I find myself this week continuing to be concerned about a distinction which I'm finding between translation and interpretation. The sense you have of your father saying that literature is not very useful for teaching history, the sense of Hollander wanting Ceylon to in some way redeem a language, which is an obvious desire on Hollander's part to have that be. I mean, he wants to state it and then have people simply say, oh, yes, of course, that's what happened. Now I see it. And then the sense of yours, I don't understand to what extent that was an issue generally that Ceylon should have or not, should or not have received this word from Heidegger in this further conversation that they might then have had. How involved is everyone involved with Ceylon in that issue, or is that a personal issue to you? And that's why you're now bringing it up. Is it a thing that whenever persons who are really involved with Ceylon, this is one of the things which comes into the conversation to be discussed? And why? Why is it important?
Right. I love these questions. These get to the heart of the why read this work. I mean, just on the practical level, yes, this poem for Heidegger has become one of the most written of Ceylon's poems, and has drawn to writing about Ceylon's work many Heideggerian thinkers in a very wonderful way, writing about poetry as being the place where important philosophical questions are posed. And so in that sense, it's really great. Derrida has written a book. Derrida, there's another non-French Jew coming from Algeria, creating French culture. And Blanchot and many others. The question of this word, whether this word came, well, the question of it is first posed by Ceylon in this poem, in the sense that he cites hope for this word, and so it's a legitimate then to say, well, what is this word, and was the hope answered? But the line, he puts it back into the poem, yeah. For me, what's makes that such an important question, and what makes me glad that it's not answered, is that I feel that there is this desire to be done with this time, with this 50-year-old event, to just be done with it, to understand it, and to say it's no longer relevant to our you know, cultural practice, however you want to put it. The Holocaust. But not even just the Holocaust, but even to put it in the larger sense, that, you know, what totalitarianism has revealed of ourselves in this century. And the idea of wanting apologies from figures who are in some way tainted by the war, or of wanting to forgive figures who are in some way tainted by the war, is thoroughly understandable, and I think it should always be, but I think it's best not to have that. I really do. And I'm fascinated by the attraction between two individuals who are both tainted by the war, one as a perpetrator, so-called, and one as a victim. And in that relationship, I think that there's a lot to be learned about this question of one's complicity or one's responsibility as an agent in history. And in Ceylon's work, that's always being brought up. And his complicity as a practitioner of the German language is always being cited and not answered. And it's the continual non-answering of that that I think interests me. There's a phrase in my very first letter to Benjamin, and I should say in Benjamin's behalf that this was his belief 5 years ago, and that's not his belief or his desire now. I cited from Conversation in the Mountains a line that absolutely rung true to me as the psychology of the survivor, or one type of psychology of one type of survivor, where the two Jews are talking and one says to the other, "Do you hear me?" And then Ceylon writes, "But do you hear me?" does not answer. He is one with the glaciers. And this being one with the glaciers is very much the feeling of the verse. And later on reading, I found this really remarkable word in the verse that brings back to that passage, but cites anew this question of how does one speak about this event? Can one speak about this event without in some way trying to assuage the pain that it continually engenders in us? And so there's this word, glacier scream, Gletschergeschrei. Now, I'll write this down to show this. This is why Ceylon is not translatable. So in this word, there is this other word encapsulated in the ice, sherga, which means Sherpa. So that in this glacier scream, there is this person who's carrying one's bags up the mountain. There is this servant. And I'm sorry? Really?
Oh, yes.
Oh, not in my dictionary. I'm glad to learn that.
Well, it does. Yeah. Henchman.
That's fantastic.
The executioner's assistant. Sherigan. The Sherigan. Sherigan, those are the guys that come in and capture the hero and take him off the dungeon.
Wow. Does it mean Sherpa also? Is that correct? Well, so this word stopped me in my tracks, and I don't know if Bobby, if this is not that I actually want to answer your question, but I would want to begin to answer it. I mean, in the sense that I don't want to say this is how it is. I feel that in this word and in this what this encapsulates is somehow like what I would see as Ceylon's stance towards the problem of giving expression to something that is, you know, according to the pundits, the inexpressible.
In Alan Dershowitz's latest book, he talks about how modern Jews are always being asked to put the Holocaust behind them, whereas no one would ever ask an African-American to put the slavery behind them. And the distinction baffles him and it baffles me. Could you speak to it?
Well, I disagree. I think African Americans are always asked to put slavery behind them, actually. I think it's something that's asked of everyone who has any kind of grievance. And grievance isn't even the right word. I mean, just, you know, you want to remember, you know, I mean, like this idea of like that we went to war so that we could forget Vietnam, as if like that would be something that we would want to accomplish. So in that sense, I don't see Jews as being treated differently.
It's possible that guilt is a technical term in Heidegger's philosophy. Perhaps that might be a sufficient, do you think? If it were, would that be sufficient?
Sufficient in what? You mean to like...
As an acknowledgement of of complicity.
Well, probably not explicit, but... But maybe implicitly it could be read that way, yeah. Right. I mean, when all this stuff came to light about Paul Damon having written these articles for this fascist-controlled newspaper in Belgium, then they said that all his essays on Rousseau and Confession were in some way allegorical attempts to speak of his own guilt. It makes for a very exciting reading, which I'm all in favor of that.
I was thinking in relation to Bobby's excellent questions. I think it's also it points up a difference in the respective cultures of Germany or the Germanophone world and the United States of America, in that it's and I guess this has something to do with interpretations of freedom of speech as well, in the sense that the German post-World War II culture has, by and large, demanded either apologies or recantations from people such as, I guess Gottfried Benn passed away before they could really do that to him. But Ernst Jünger, whom you mentioned, and so on. Whereas here, I just recently spent two pleasant days at a mountain resort where one of the permanent residents is a by now fairly ancient Southern writer who has written a book in which he compares General Nathan Bedford Forrest to Jesus. And no one objects to this.
Well, who's no one? Well, I do. Who reads it?
Well, I don't know. See, the thing is, yeah, maybe we don't read anymore. That's the point.
Maybe we don't read that.
I must have read that.
Done with that question?
Yeah.
I had a comment. You said you mentioned early on that he dealt with the Holocaust by not writing about it. I think that was one of your phrases. And I worked at the Jewish Home for the Aged in San Francisco in 76. And the people I dealt with were 20 people. It was 20 apartments, and everybody there, the only reason they could get there was if they had survived the concentration camps. They all had numbers. They all always wore long sleeves and never discussed it. And the only reason you would know it is if you had to go to their room late at night to take care of them or something, you'd see their numbers. And I was wondering if he chose not to write about it or if he was unable to write about it.
I think probably until a biography of him as an adult comes out, we won't really thoroughly know. And there are some of the poems that he wrote about the war, and the famous one, Death Fugue, which he did not, later in his life, would not allow to be reprinted in anthologies. He felt that it had become a way for Germans to, you know, it had become a sentimental poem. And for instance, his son, who's living in Paris, who's apparently a juggler in a circus that travels around Europe, would probably be the one to ask whether he ever talked about the war. I don't know. I've read some psychology books where they say about survivors, there's the ones that speak and the ones that don't. And though that's literally true, I think what I think is that everyone speaks, but what the signs that they use are different. And I think that to me, that was what was profound about Ceylon's work. What I recognized in him was this profound negativity that uses other objects as signs for what really is the content of the work. I think it's not really a matter of whether he wrote about it or spoke about it or didn't. I think it's much more the dynamic between what was spoken of and what wasn't. And the other thing is, The first thing that's important in speaking about some event like this is telling the stories, giving the information. But the other thing is letting it be known how this information should be taken, which is the context for it, or how one feels about it. For instance, let me see if I can think of a good example. I mean, it's sort of like a code, and once you get the key, you know how to read it. And so you know, it's like in how you can, if you're close to someone, you can tell when they're upset without them saying it. This isn't necessarily communication, but this is the way, but it's a transmission. And well, I'm feeling stymied to think of a good example. Well, yeah. Well, I'm trying to do the. I'm trying to say that if someone doesn't speak about something, it doesn't mean that, that he's not that, that he she is not making a communication about it, and that what one learns, I mean, it's what any child learns about one's parents is how to read them. You know, how to. This is a good example. I mean, in choosing this name. He's using Tomas of Ceylano in whatever way that Ceylon is paying witness to this event. And for the most part, I think he's paying witness in the name of his mother, to whom, according to the biography, he was very close, and for whom I think he named both of his children, and who I think references are embedded all throughout the work. If he's the witness to his mother, Friederike, known as Fritzi, and in doing this, chooses the name of a Catholic writer who was paying witness to a saint. That's a misdirection in which a communication is being made about the act of witnessing. That's not direct information about himself. And when we read the biography of Francis too, there are these very poignant stories about after Francis received the stigmata, because of modesty he didn't show them, he hid them. And in this, the hiding of the wounds, I think, is probably also something that really attracted Ceylon to this figure.
I just wanted to address that point a little more, or ask you to just about the hiding of the wounds, that it seems like there is some concurrence of the long sleeves as somehow a symbol as poignant as the tattoo itself, the covering of it, so that without covering it, that would be almost saying that, yes, I was branded, whereas covering it is a way of saying that we go on from here, or I don't know if you want to talk about that some more.
That's right. That's the piece that I was trying to find. There's work that's about the Holocaust, but there's work then which is about what it means to live in light of that. And so the hiding becomes as important as the speaking, as the witnessing. And so in that sense, Ceylon's work is different than other poets. For instance, his friend Nelly Zox, who would write poems, you know, that are choruses of the dead and so on. It's a different kind of work.
I just wanted to say, in current like survivor psychology, there seems to be this catchphrase, disassociation. And I was just wondering that in light of, you're talking about the metaphors and going off and displacing like the ideas in other things or other people or other ideas or things like that without going directly into the actual events as some people have within the Holocaust. If you think that might be something that might be going on within the writing, it might be some sort of disassociation, but therefore, It is like a code. When you have a conversation with someone that is a survivor in any sense, whether that means something as broad and as based as the Holocaust, or something that might be smaller, more personal, or not saying that the Holocaust wasn't, but smaller, more personal, one-to-one, like, say, abuse of some sort or something like that. And the same type of writing comes out of that situation, too. I mean, working within the... being in and working within mental institutions and things of that nature, I mean, you see the same thing happening, but It was just like the disassociation kind of thing.
Yeah, I have a very sentimental attachment to the idea that there is something that happened, that there is this event. And certainly one can only measure the distance that is being crossed from it by knowing what that event is. And I guess in through some metaphor of modern physics, you know, one could say that you can postulate that event from the work itself, which is, I think, maybe the only way that we have to read, you know, a poet who's not telling us his or her secrets. That's all we can do but I'm not interested in misdirection per se. I'm really not. I'm interested in placing a work that begins as misdirection in a context in which that misdirection can be seen, read poignantly, like The Sleeves or like The Humility of Francis. And I think that succinctly is what I'm trying to do when I read the work.
I was also just thinking of the possibility of the there's a dialectic of the guilt of the perpetrator and the guilt of the survivor. And that can, of course, express itself in many ways among survivors, those who repeat, like the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, that kind of thing, and then those who hide.
I just want to say two things. First, you mentioned John Felstener, and he was a professor of mine. He translated this one poem that actually sort of speaks in a different sense from what you're speaking about. And this one poem that I remember, he was speaking mostly about hope. And it goes, "There will be something soon now that brims full with you and rises up toward a mouth. Out of a shard-strewn craze, I rise up and look upon my hand, how it draws the one and only circle." And that's a poem that he translated for his wife for their anniversary, and so he saw a lot of hope in that. The other thing that I was going to say is, just with all the language that you've been using and that we've been talking about with this poem to Heidegger, the word and the book, this book, and whether or not he's a redemptive poet and all these things, I can't help but thinking in Christian symbolism. And everybody's nodding, and I guess it's sort of obvious, but one interpretation I was just dreaming up over there about this poem is that maybe when he's asking for a word from the heart for the book, like the first book that I think of is the Bible, and it doesn't apply to him as a Jew, and that whole history doesn't apply to him, although he might want that kind of redemption. And then the second sense, yeah, I don't know. I mean, not necessarily redemption from Christ, but just forgiveness, being able to forgive or whatever. The other thing, though, I know it's confusing, so I'm sort of lost too, but the other thing is that he might want that kind of word from this book, and not meaning this book that he's written, but this book that he wrote into, and whether that all of that can be tied into reclaiming a power and to reclaiming the power of German language and all the stuff. So just some thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I think that your interpretation of the Heidegger poem is probably the reigning one right now. I mean, it's worth saying that his wife, Giselle, was a French Catholic woman. Her mother was actually had and I hadn't thought of saying this to you, Kristen. Her mother had joined a convent and was a nun, in fact. And that this book, Sprachgitter, this strange word, speech grill, is actually one of its meanings is it's the grill that one, in a certain order, you speak through to cloistered nuns. And apparently, this was the kind of nunnery that his mother-in-law was a member of. And I think his fascination with Christianity, and specifically Catholicism, has a lot to do with this dynamic of the figure that is that suffers for the sake of mankind, and that gives that get, that that gives meaning to suffering, and that redemption is on the order of healing the wounds. I think he was powerfully attracted to that and never lets go of that, but I don't think that he allows himself to subscribe to it in the same sense that he didn't allow himself to be a Zionist and go to Israel. And I can't remember whether it's Benjamin or Ceylon who says it, but it's certainly applicable to either of them. One of them said, it's my fate to live out the fate of the Jew in Europe. And that's why I think that it can't simply be said that the work is a refutation or that it's a redemption, because he's caught between the two of them. I mean, he's hung on a nail, so to say. And actually, I mean, Janet, what you said about the guilt is at the basis of it, in the sense that, guilt is something that holds you fast. It doesn't let you, it's what doesn't let you let go of the past or of your pain. And in that sense, I think a survivor has no choice but to hold on to guilt. In the same sense that, you can't remove a tattoo. And, psychology has been woefully inadequate in answering that. And that's why so many survivors commit suicide. This is why Benjamin Hollander felt that we were stirring up stuff that we shouldn't be stirring up. So that even in the last, even in the last 4 years, 50 years afterwards, Jerzy Kaczynski commits suicide, Primo Levi commits suicide. And someone told me the story about Kaczynski, that he had insomnia, and so he used to go to emergency rooms in the middle of the night to, watch, as entertainment. talking about, not being able to let go. Thanks, everybody, for coming, taking part.